This morning, as you know, we read about the plagues that culminate in the weeks ahead in the liberation of the children of Israel from Egypt. Biyad chazaka uvizroa netuya, with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Why do you need both? Why doesn't God just liberate them with a mighty hand? That ought to be enough. What does God need an outstretched arm for? If you take this as more than poetry, in fact, one commentator suggests a reason. He says an outstretched arm to liberate the Israelites from Egypt, or a mighty hand, rather, to liberate the Israelites from Egypt, and an outstretched arm to make sure they don't go back there. Because they all wanted to go back. Rabbi Shmuel Mulliver says he understands why the sea opened so the Israelites could go through. He says, but most people don't realize why it closed again. It wasn't to drown the Egyptians, it was to make sure that the Israelites didn't go back. Because they were ready. They wanted to go back because they were used to slavery. In fact, according to one commentator, that was when God liberated them. When they were so enslaved that they didn't even feel that they were slaves anymore. We talked this morning about Choshech, about darkness, and that there was light in Goshen, in the place where the Israelites dwelt. But where was that light from? According to the Kotzker Rebbe, it was the Or HaGanuz, the primordial light, the light that shined in the first few days of creation before the sun was made. And that every Jew has that light inside of them. Every human being, potentially, has that light inside of them. But how do you bring it out, is the question. And I think the answer is the same answer that we give when we ask why were the Israelites used to slavery. This morning I am going to offer you great wisdom on how to shape characters for good or for bad. And I can call it great wisdom because it's borrowed wisdom. It is not mine. But it is true. Our tradition puts it, mitzvah goreret mitzvah, avera goreret avera. One mitzvah brings another mitzvah. One sin brings another sin. Let me tell you how we put it in modern English. This great, often unrecognized truth of character. We use the word habit. It's a habit. When we look at Moshe and we see that as he left Pharaoh's palace, the first thing he saw was an Egyptian striking a Jew. The second thing he sees is two Jews fighting each other. The third thing that he is told, that we're told that he sees, is when he goes off to Midian and two Midianites are in a quarrel. We understand that Moshe is in the habit of noticing injustice. This is what he does. And in order to explain this, I'm going to turn to one of the great teachers of the American tradition, the philosopher William James, who wrote a brilliant and insightful essay in his series of Talks to Teachers, and the essay was called Habit. And he writes, in the majority of instances, when we speak about habits, it's bad habits we have in mind. They talk of the smoking habit, or the swearing habit, or the drinking habit. But not of the abstention habit, or the moderation habit, or the courage habit. We don't talk about our virtues as habits, but he says our virtues are habits as much as our vices. It's a habit to drink, but it's also a habit to be polite. It's a habit to curse, but it's also a habit to speak nicely. And the cultivation of good habits is part of the secret of character. Why did the Israelites want to go back to Egypt? Because they were used to it. Being a slave had become habitual, and God had to make it a habit to be free. We understand the power of bad habits. They are so powerful that the Talmud says that when you commit a sin the first time, you know it's a sin, but when you commit a sin the second time, you think it's permissible. So someone asked Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, what happens when you commit a sin a third time? He said, then you think it's a mitzvah. That's how powerful habit is. Is once you become used to something, you find reasons to justify it. It's not just that you're allowed to do it, it's a mitzvah. And we are all creatures of habit. One of my teachers and Rabbi Schuldenfrei's teachers at the seminary was Neil Gilman. He used to say to us, if you want to understand the power of ritual, this is what you do. Take a child's favorite book, one that they've read 100 times, read it to them and skip a few words. They'll say, no. That's not how it's supposed to go. And you say to yourself, why do they have to hear it if they know it by heart? The answer is, it's ritual. It's a habit. And we build those habits in ourselves and in our children. And we can build good habits or bad habits. Hergel na'aseh teva sheni, our tradition tells us. Habit is second nature. It becomes who you are. The Duke of Wellington, a good witness, since after all, among other things, he was the one who beat Napoleon, which makes you a fairly accomplished individual, said it's not true that habit is second nature. Habit is 10 times nature. And he said this, why? Because he trained soldiers. And he knew that in order to train the kind of fighting force that can destroy a Napoleon, you have to drill them and make fighting habitual. And the same thing is true in life. So you ask, if William James is so smart, why doesn't he tell us how to acquire good habits? You'll be pleased to know that he does. And since he told us, I'm going to tell you. 4 rules to acquiring habits. Now, it may be a little hard to understand his phrasing of it. For each one, I will rephrase. 1, acquiring a new habit or leaving off an old one, we must take care to launch ourselves with as strong and decided an initiative as possible. In other words, give yourself a big send-off. Resolution should be big. Don't say, you know what, I'm drinking every day, so tomorrow I'm going to have a little bit less. That's not a big send-off. That's not a big launch. When you're going to change direction, you have to do it with full blasters at your back. As strong as you can. As hard as you can. In order to change the direction of something that you know is bad, or to begin something that you know is good. Don't say, it really is important for me to go to synagogue, so I'll go sometime next year. And 2, and this may be the single most important in all of James' arsenal of advice, never suffer an exception to occur till the new habit is securely rooted in your life. Do it again and again and again and again until you can't think of not doing it. That's when you're allowed to make an exception. To take a small example, floss every night for a year, then on the 366th day, you can skip. Or, to take a better example, put tefillin on every morning for a year. And then, in the second year, you can skip a day. In other words, says James, habit will in fact become who you are, but it takes a while. And as long as you're still debating whether to do it, it's not a habit yet. Do you debate? How to get dressed in the morning? No. Most people get dressed the same way every morning. First you put on your pants, first you put on your shirt. You brush your teeth before breakfast, after breakfast. We're all what James calls bundles of habits. But those habits get developed over years, and they take time to do or to undo. So here's a habit. When people are talking about someone, make it a habit to say something nice about them. I'm not even going to say make it a habit to never say anything negative. I don't want to overreach in my first habit talk. But you can make it a habit to say something nice, and it can become a habit, like anything else. You reprogram, if you like this kind of vocabulary better, your neurocircuitry, so that when someone's name comes up, you say something nice. Not only that, but James says very powerfully, he says, you know, oftentimes we get an impulse to do something nice. We think to ourselves, oh, they just had a bar mitzvah, I should send a note. He said, when you get such an impulse, do it right away. And the reason is, impulses to do good things, like any other impulse, can dry up and shrivel. If enough times you say, oh, I should do it sometime, but you don't do it, eventually you'll lose the impulse too. Part of the reason you'll lose the impulse is because you'll have such a backlog. You'll say, well, I didn't send the last 100 bar mitzvah notes, so I can't start now. So your impulses, especially those that are good, should be exercised. If you see someone begging on the street and you have an impulse to give them money, give them money. Yes, it may be true that they won't use it wisely or they'll use it to drink or so on, but I'm not talking now about them. I'm talking about us, our impulses. And if your impulse is to be charitable, don't withhold it because you're doing something to your own soul. And cultivating an impulse again and again and again makes you good. Let me give you another example. That was applause. In my career, as every rabbi has this career I've discovered, as a fundraiser, let me tell you what I have discovered. People who give money, give again. And then they give again. And they give to other organizations too. And then when you approach them, they give again. Because they are in the habit of giving, and people who don't give money, don't give again. And they don't give again. And when they're approached by someone else, they don't give again. And when other fundraisers speak to other people, they say, don't approach them, they don't give. And it's not necessarily, and I really mean this, because they are hard-hearted or stingy or don't care. It's because they have not developed the habit of tzedakah. And once they do, they discover how it enriches your life, which is why people who are in the habit of giving, give again. Because giving, like so much in our life, which we think of as some deep inner decision that roils inside our souls, is largely a habit. And one, by the way, that we not only want to cultivate in ourselves, but in our children. We encourage our daughter to give tzedakah, not because her pennies will make the difference to the tzedakah drive, but because she should have the habit. I remember when I was growing up, we had those little blue and white JNF boxes. And before Shabbat, we were all supposed to put money in the JNF box. I have no idea whatever became of all that money. I'm sure there are forests in Israel because of the Walpi pennies. But it was good training because it developed the habit of giving. Therefore, says James, seize the first opportunity to act on every resolution you make and on every emotional prompting in the direction of the habits you aspire to gain. Do it. Because it'll make a difference. And lastly, he says, and I'm quoting this to you even though I know how it's going to sound coming from me, don't preach too much. Gotta be honest. And this is what he means. Let me explain. He says, when people are excited about starting a new habit, one of the things they tend to do is they go around to everybody and tell them what they're doing. Then next week, everybody says, so how's it going with the, with the new gym routine? And you say, huh? Gym routine? I don't remember. What was that with the gym? I never went to a gym. He says, the idea of starting a habit is actually not to spend your time talking about it, but to do it. And the doing of it will spread the word because it will become part of your character. And then he adds one last exercise, which is not so much about habit, but which is a wonderful thing to remember. He says we should exercise our wills every day by doing something difficult. Don't sink into laziness. If you live a life where it's possible to get by every day without meeting some resistance, then force yourself to meet some resistance. Do something hard. Because the human will, like everything else, like the human body, has to be trained to perform well. And so when someone asks you to do something that's hard to do, do it. Because it's part of the toning of your will, says James. Now, one of the things I have always felt about James is that in the core of his philosophy of shaping character, he's very Jewish. Because this is just what our tradition teaches us. Mitoch shelo lishma ba lishma, the rabbis say. You start off doing something for the wrong reason, but if you do it often enough, you will come to do it for the right reason. Maybe first you do it because you have to, but in time, you'll do it because you want to. Maybe you come to synagogue because you got to. Your parents tell you to. There's a family that's expecting you to be there, but in time, you connect to other people in the community. You discover something inside yourself. You feel a sense of God. We have a system of mitzvot because we believe that mitzvot shape character. In fact, in the Talmud, it says that the mitzvot were given rak litzaref et habriot, only to refine our characters. That's the only reason. That's why we have them. In other words, God wanted us to develop good habits. God wanted us to develop habits of goodness. And here's where the two come together. James and Judaism. In the recognition that what we do shapes who we are. And that is the opposite of what a lot of people will tell you. They'll tell you that what you are shapes what you do. But the opposite is true. What you do shapes what you are. If you give, you're a giving person. If you say nice things, you become more kind. If you train people to be polite, it will soften their hearts. Is it 100% true all the time? Of course not. We have too much going on inside of us to say that the way you act automatically completely reshapes you as though you're made of clay. But it is certainly true that much of what we are is shaped by what we do. And we can make choices. And we can change. The Greeks used to say that character is destiny. What becomes of you in this life depends ultimately on who you are. And who you are, our tradition teaches us, depends on what you do. So in the end, the Israelites, in fact, take over the land of Canaan and make it the land of Israel. And they did it because God wouldn't let them go back. God, so to speak, dragged them out of bed, set the alarm, told them they didn't have a choice, and forced them to go to Shul. And locked the doors so they couldn't go back home. And they discovered that what they thought of as a disruption of their life was in fact a sacred mission. All of us face obstacles, and all of us develop habits that don't aid our souls. But what James wrote at the end of the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century is what our tradition taught us thousands of years ago, which is that slavery is a habit and freedom is an achievement. And so is goodness. and so is holiness. And we have the guide right here, right there, to develop habits of goodness and ways of holiness. We know how to do it, and we know when. That is, every instant that we are lucky enough to live. So I hope that over the weeks and months ahead, we'll remember the sea closing behind us and realize that what we are forcing ourselves to do is to become better, and to realize that the rabbis knew exactly what they meant when they told us that Hergel Ne'aseh Teva Sheni, that we can train ourselves to be better, to be more giving, to be more loving, to be closer to one another, and to be closer to God. Shabbat Shalom.